Thank you, Keith. Keith was he's a real soldier. I was a Guard and Reserve guy, and no slam on them, but I was not worth much. But I did put in 28 years and enjoyed it, and I've got my retirement card, and I get to go shop at the PX and stuff like that. But anyway, I was infantry, but again, I never got shot at and didn't do much good or much harm. Incidentally, I did grow up in Arkansas. I was born in Tennessee, and I knew President Clinton before he was president. We were in the same band once. We were an Arkansas All-State band, and he played tenor sax, and I played trumpet. And I talked to him once when he visited Wachita Baptist, where I attended school. And anyway, he became a Rhodes Scholar. He was on the way to Oxford, and he wrote me from Oxford, wrote a note to me in 1969, and I kept that note. And later, I was able to sell it for $850 to a group that collects things like that. So I have that warm connection. But that's about it. I was serving in the Pentagon, actually, when Don't Ask, Don't Tell was announced. I was doing what they call IMA duty, Individual Mobilization Augmentee duty. I did 11 years in the Pentagon in the Office of Chief of Public Affairs and Office of Chief of Army Reserve. And I would go two weeks a year for 11 years. And anyway, one of the times I was there, I believe it was at Fort McNair across the river that the announcement was made. And I know in my office there was not a lot of appreciation for that announcement. I mean, the military is not not that warmly disposed. At least he was, President Clinton was starting by saying that we are going to make it fine for gays to practice openly. And there was so much blowback that they compromised with Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But I do remember that day. There are actually a number of people in the Army who are sort of sexually transgressive in a variety of ways, whether they are adulterers or unmarried fornicators, and so they kind of take an easy breezy approach to sexuality. But the great majority of people there that I served with in the Pentagon found it odious that someone who had not served in the military and who had actually kind of finessed his way out of it would somehow be drawing lines. And I noticed yesterday, or opening things up, I noticed yesterday President Obama, through his administration in the UN, was pushing for global accommodation of homosexuality, actually homosexuality, bisexuality, transgender, and so forth, around the world, and that all discrimination be removed. That's a major, major emphasis of this administration. And there's another person who hasn't served in the military, and I find that kind of thing odious. I will say this, my focus is upon service in the military, the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. It's an entirely different issue whether homosexuality should be legal in America. I think that it should be, that you shouldn't go to prison for being a homosexual. The Lawrence case in Texas made sense to me, even though homosexuality is a great evil. I'm very opposed to movements to normalize homosexuality, but the legality is a different issue. That being said, what about service in the military? As I've reflected on this, I've come up with about, for today, a dozen reasons why I think it's a bad thing to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And I'm just going to track through them very quickly, and then we'll have time for questions and answers. Let me say this. Look, if we're being invaded, I'm thinking, I live up on the North Shore of Chicago, and if like Al-Qaeda has a flotilla coming across, you know, from Michigan, you kind of want everybody on the shore. You know, if the military is not quite up there, I want old people, I want deaf people, I want, whatever, if they can point in the right direction, blind people, whatever we can meet them on the shore with. But it's one thing to be in an emergency situation where you're defending things, and another to institute what we call SOP, standing operating procedures or standard operating procedures. And I think it's terrible SOP to just open the military up to gays, avowed gays and practicing gays. Now look, in connection with like in dire times, let me say this. There's a famous woman, I think her name was Mary Hayes. She has the nickname Molly Pitcher. And at the Battle of Monmouth in the American Revolution, when George Washington was leading the troops, her husband was killed on the field of battle. And she stepped in and took his place at an artillery piece, and she was like carrying supplies to the gun, and actually also I think maybe using the ramrod and so forth. And her name is Molly Pitcher, at least in legend. And Yeah, if things are dire, then let a woman step into an artillery unit. I think of another case. Do you remember at Virginia Tech when there was that shooting not that long ago, and this guy burst into a big classroom? I think it was an engineering class. One of the most heroic people in that setting, or perhaps the only heroic person in that setting, was a 75-year-old engineering professor from Israel who was a Holocaust survivor. He was from Romania. And he was over from Israel. His name was Liviu Librescu. He was 75, a senior researcher and lecturer in engineering. And what he did was he burst in and he jammed the door and he held the door against the shooter, and while people were able to scramble out the window or scramble under desks. So in the pinch, in the bind, yes, but to make it standing operating procedure that we're going to draft 75-year-olds and let them serve openly, that's another thing entirely. Now, I will say this, some homosexuals have been very helpful to the war effort. There's a fellow named Alan Turing, T-U-R-I-N-G, and in World War II, he served in the British Codebreakers office at what's called Bletchley Park, and he was a genius, and he ended up developing a machine that mirrored the Enigma code machine of the Germans, and they were able to break some of the ultra code and intercept these things. After the war, since homosexuality was illegal in Britain, he was hounded for that and underwent some treatments. Finally, he committed suicide. And it's a very sad thing. He was a genius, and he was helpful to the war effort. So I have no doubt that a homosexual can be useful to defense of the nation, and I have no doubt that in a bind, all kinds of people can be called in to help. But again, we're talking about what should be basic policy day in, day out, and it strikes me that don't ask, don't tell is the minimum that that we should do. By the way, it has a little bit to do with the women in the military thing, that women don't serve in combat units. Now, you have places where they are find themselves in a combat situation. You remember Jessica Lynch in the first war. What was that, the Gulf War? I think that was called the Gulf War. It was the Gulf War, not the Iraq War. And I'm getting this mixed up. It was the Iraq War. It was the beginning. And she was in a transportation unit, and they got turned around and got boxed in, and then she was taken along with, I think, a woman of American Indian background. And so you can find yourself in a combat situation if you're a woman, but we still have that basic standard that women are not infantrymen, for example. Does that mean that a woman can't shoot a rifle, that a woman can't, slap on a pack and walk over land and, you know, and sweat and cuss like the rest of us? Yeah, they can. But as a general policy, it would be imprudent, I think, for this to happen, and it strikes me it's imprudent for gays. Well, let me give you 12 quick reasons. First is a question of privacy. When I was taking, I think it was Air War College, we take these correspondence courses when we're reservists, and you have to write papers. One of the papers I wrote had to do with the gays in the military issue. And I came up with a kind of a niche issue, and that it has to do with privacy, and that is the law's protection of people who are undressed from a lustful viewing. Let me give you an example. There have been legal cases where men prisoners, have said, we object to women prison guards walking by our cells all the time. In these cells, we go to the bathroom, we change our clothes, and then just as soon as I'm changing clothes, this woman walks by, and it's like, yikes, you know? And it's like, well, what's wrong? I mean, her eyes aren't like laser-like. They don't burn you, you know? And do you think she's learning anything she doesn't know? And, you know, and by the way, you're a pretty rough customer anyway. But they said, look, I have a right not to be looked at by a woman in a state of undress if I don't want to. And they have won in the courts. There are also cases involving department stores where you'll have like a women's dressing room and there will be a special two-way mirror or there will be a peephole or something like this, and they'll discover that one of the store employees is looking at these people in dressing rooms, and the guy can't say, well, I didn't hurt her, you know, didn't hurt her at all. She picked out the right dress or whatever and she went about her life and she wasn't crippled and so forth, so what, no harm, no foul. But the courts do not say that's the case. They say you have a right to be, if you're going to be in states of undress, you have a right to be, to choose where you will be that way. And so it means that you should not be forced in situations where you're observed by those of the other sex. Well, you know, with homosexuals, you have something of the other sex perspective. And incidentally, in the military, I mean, there is no modesty in the military among men. I mean, whether it's the induction physical, where they line you all up there and check all sorts of unspeakable things, or it's you're in the field for 5 or 6 days, and they come with these big cattle trucks, and they said, we got a bath unit in. Everybody jump on the trucks, and they take you out, and they have this big tent with these kind of pallets that you walk on, and it's a unit devoted to giving you baths and showers, and you're just all mixed in together there. So, and of course, within the tent and so forth, if you're in a squad tent or whatever, there's not a place for modesty. And it is just a small thing, perhaps, but it is the case that the U.S. law says you shouldn't be vulnerable to those of the opposite sex viewing you in states of undress unless you want to be there. Just a small thing, and we just run right over that. Second thing I'll mention, it is driven by the goal of normalizing perversion, not to enhance combat readiness. You know, it's not as though the Pentagon has said, we are so desperate. You know, we just don't have enough riflemen. We don't have enough, you know, we have got to draft the gays. First, I mean, there are various studies. Kinsey said it was 11%, but I think Stanley Jones at Wheaton and others have said it's more like 1% or 2%, the number of gays. It's not as though there's this vast resource of homosexual combat-ready folks or people who could be trained, and we're desperate for these people, that the national security depends upon this great army of gays being enlisted in the military. We're not in that much of a bind. I was reading Time magazine the other night, and there was a lady named Elizabeth Gilbert who's written a novel called Eat, Pray, Love, and she is honored as one of the 100 people most influential in the world by Time magazine. And they asked these people who were honored whom they would vote for Person of the Year. She said, my vote would go to the gay American soldier. The courage that it has taken for these warriors to step forward, risk their careers, alienate their families, and demand to be heard, accepted, and honored is beyond heroic. The change that eradicating Don't Ask, Don't Tell could mean for the world redefined the code of military history and set an example of courage and tolerance to the world is huge. What does that have to do with defending the United States against enemies, foreign and domestic? Nothing. It has a lot to do with the agenda to advance, to normalize homosexuality. Back in 1948, President Harry Truman did something very honorable and actually very strategically important. That's when he integrated the military. You know, I just saw a movie the other day called Hearts War with Bruce Willis, and I forget who else was in it. But at any rate, it had to do with the tensions involved with Tuskegee Airmen. You know, black airmen who were flying, I think they were flying, was it P-51s, is that right, into Europe. And two of them were shot down. And as they come into the barracks in a POW camp, there are tensions about this thing. And there are sacrifice and prejudice and a variety of things like this. There are other famous units, infantry units, not just black infantry units, but then there are also other segregated units, like Japanese units, I think they called them Sensei Brigades and so forth. But in 1948, President Truman said, no more. You know, black soldiers will be integrated, no more Tuskegee Airmen. Incidentally, there were no Stonewall Airmen, you know, now let's integrate them. If you know the Stonewall incident, it was illegal to be openly gay and to be practicing this in New York, and they had a club called the Stonewall Club. And I forget the year it was, I think it was in the 60s, there was a raid on this club, and instead of going along passively, the gays pushed back and rioted. And so that's almost their Alamo, you know, that's the time when they stood up for their rights. So it's called the Stonewall, whatever. So imagine you had a Stonewall fighter unit of gay pilots, and now we're going to integrate them. There's nothing like that. But with the blacks, there was certainly that. And, of course, they have distinguished themselves in incredible ways. We have a college in Chicago called Olive Harvey on the South Side. And one of the honorees there threw himself on a grenade in a black soldier in Vietnam and saved white colleagues and earned the Medal of Honor. I have served under black officers, and gladly, when I was in the Chief of Public Affairs, the Chief of Public Affairs in the Army was a black general from Battle Creek, Michigan, and it has been absolutely worthy to help America grow up with regard to race. And actually, the military was kind of on the point of the spear in many respects there. But to be on the point of the spear and normalizing homosexuality is a terrible thing to do. I mean, it's a little bit analogous to like gambling. Should gambling be legal in the state? That's a tough issue, and it's a shame when it comes in. It's quite another issue to say, should the government run gambling, as with a lottery, where it becomes the shill, it becomes the promoter of gambling. It's one thing to have homosexuality legal. It's another thing for the government to be promoting the normalization of it. And that is what this would be. Number three, it would put chaplains who wish to preach the whole counsel of God in a bind. If the military has decided that it is negligible, whether you are gay, lesbian, transgender, or whatever, whether you're gay, then it's not exactly clear how you can get up in the pulpit and preach Romans 1 with conviction and with prophetic edge. It's almost like, look, tell me how much of this Bible I can preach here. Someone could be a plant and say, I heard the pastor running down at the post chapel, running down something which the government has already recognized as perfectly acceptable and not worthy of any discrimination. You say, well, I'm not saying it ought to be illegal. I'm just saying it's wrong. But it strikes me that the job of the chaplain gets to be more difficult. And also just in terms of counseling. If someone is gay and then they would want to be, you want to refer them to, say, Exodus International or one of the escape from the gay culture movements, then how in the world may you do that without implying that this is an unacceptable lifestyle? I just think it just makes the life of the chaplain more difficult. And it's difficult enough, you know, because there are landmines out there and political correctness and so forth. Number four, it further degrades the Uniform Code of Military Justice's article on behavior unbecoming and on moral turpitude. I don't know if you remember the case of, I forget her first name, but it's First Lieutenant Flynn, and she was serving on B-52 crews out of Minot, North Dakota. There's an Air Force base up there in Minot, a town whose motto is, "Why not? Why not?" Well, I'll tell you why not. It's cold up there, but at any rate, she was mission qualified on the B-52 Stratofortress, and she participated in missions and so forth. They charged her with adultery with a soccer coach at Minot, and he was married to a female enlisted subordinate. Conduct unbecoming an officer, disobeying a lawful order, making a false official statement. So she was an adulteress, not with another soldier under the command, but with the husband of someone who was enlisted. And she ended up withdrawing from the military. Her career was shattered because she was an adulteress. This is becoming more and more quaint. Listen to this part of Article 133 of the UCMJ. Any commissioned officer, cadet, or midshipman who is convicted of conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman shall be punished as a court-martial may direct. The nature of the offense. Conduct violative of this article is action or behavior in an official capacity which, in dishonoring or disgracing the person as an officer, seriously compromises the officer's character as a gentleman, or action or behavior in an unofficial or private capacity which is dishonoring or disgracing the officer personally and seriously compromises the person standing as an officer. There are certain moral attributes common to the ideal officer and the perfect gentleman, a lack of which is indicated by acts of dishonesty, unfair dealing, indecency, indecorum, lawlessness, injustice, and cruelty. Not everyone is or can be expected to meet unrealistically high moral standards, but there is a limit of tolerance based on customs of the service and military necessity below which the personal standards of an officer, cadet, or midshipman cannot fall without seriously compromising the person standing as an officer, and so forth. Examples. Instances of violation of this article shall include knowingly making a false statement, dishonorable failure to pay a debt, cheating on an exam, opening and reading a letter of another without authority, using insulting or defamatory language to another officer in that officer's presence or about that officer to other military persons, being drunk and disorderly in a public place, public association with known prostitutes, committing or attempting to commit a crime involving moral turpitude and failing without good cause to support the officer's family. Notions of moral turpitude and indecency. It's just shrinking, shrinking, shrinking. What's going to be left? Is it going to be like bestiality? But, you know, what if the animal didn't complain, you know? And what if it was done discreetly? I mean, at what point do we finally say, that's really disgusting? Well, this will be one more way we can't say that's disgusting. Number five, the drive to normalize perversion is insatiable. I mean, there is this notion that, okay, if we give on this, then they'll be happy, and now, no, they will not be happy. It'll be the next thing. And it will be not only allowing it, but allowing it to become flamboyant and without any hitch and so forth. I'll give you an example. I don't know if you follow the news, but I'm Baptist Collegiate Ministry Director at Northwestern University, and we had a scandal recently. We have a sex ed class there, sexual something class, I forget. And there are like 622 students in it. The professor is pretty raw, and the students love it. They have these demos after class. He invites special people to come in and talk, and he says, okay, you don't have to stay, and this won't be on the test, so I'll give you a chance to walk out. But this is a regular feature, and he'll have swingers come in and talk about their lifestyle, or he'll have prostitutes talk about their lifestyle. But the other day, he had a couple come in who performed a sexual act. I won't be specific about this. If you look at this week's Weekly Standard, you'll see it's the cover article. Joseph Epstein wrote about it. And it was just like, you have got to be kidding. And 122 students stayed, and none of them complained. They were warned, if you stay, you can't complain. And so they were all there happy. And the Northwestern University sponsored it. School initially, the administrator said, well, freedom, you know, academic freedom and this and that. And until I think trustees and donors and parents started saying, have you lost your minds? And now they're going to investigate it a little bit. So they've developed a bit of a conscience. But this professor just keeps pushing and pushing and pushing. The chaplain's office didn't say anything about it because it is very laid back about the great expanse of convictions and so forth, but you would think someone inside would thunder against this sort of thing. As one fellow observed, you can't do this in the strip clubs of Chicago, what these guys did, but you can do it in a university classroom. And as though people were confused, like, oh, we need knowledge. Oh, thank you very much. Now we have deeper understanding of what this is about. I mean, it was just sheer titillation, and it was pushing the boundaries and trying to normalize that which would be, in most generations, in most parts of the world, shameful or private or something like this. So, if we say yes to gays in the military, then the next will be gay, yes to bisexuals in the military, transgender people in the military. We have an office, sometimes they call it the Gilbert office, it's the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender office in the student center at Northwestern, and it is a block to say that you cannot criticize without being guilty of hate speech. So the next thing would be the right for transgender people to show up. I mean, we laugh in MASH at Corporal Klinger, you know, who in off-duty traipses around camp in a dress. We laugh, but it could well be the case that you just say off-duty. We've got to allow transgender people, cross-dressers, transvestites to practice. How dare we draw a line? I mean, if the guy picks up a rifle and he can do his job and the enemy charges, then that's fine. Or is that fine? You can have pansexual people. By the way, do you realize that when you say bisexual is okay, you're saying promiscuity is okay? Because to exercise the bi, that means you have to have two different partners. I mean, forget the gender. That just means that you are sleeping around one way or the other, to use a euphemism. And so by accommodating that, you're accommodating, of course, just adultery and winking at it and saying it's no, or promiscuity or whatever, it's no problem at all. There is no limit to what they will press. And if finally you're allowed to have Corporal Klinger, then the next thing they'll press for is that the officer corps have Corporal Klinger. You know, it's like, oh, well, you can have some guys sort of down in the ranks, but they will not stop until the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is a cross-dresser. I mean, any limit they see, they will attack. So it is a ravenous beast, and you'll just be feeding it if you go with this. Number six, there's a fair amount. And by the way, there are books about this. Here's a Don't Ask, Don't Tell debate book I just got. And here's a book that's for sale in the Northwestern bookstore, The Postmodern Military, and they talk about other nations that have done this. In fairly recent years, New Zealand, Australia, United Kingdom have opened the ranks to gays. And so they're saying, you know, they haven't had riots and they haven't been, you know, degraded or whatever, whatever. Actually, the jury is still out on a number of these things. They don't dwell so much on the fact that other nations have drawn lines and continue to hold lines. Germany is one of these. I was reading about German practice. Basically, they don't press it, and so there are some gays that come into the German ranks. But it's basically understood that you are not going to rise in the ranks. If you're looking at fitness reports, whether you can hope to become a company commander or a battalion commander or whatever, don't even dream of it in the German army. And yet they're saying, well, it's working other places. Well, first, even if it is, I think it's awfully important to hold up what we would call American exceptionalism. We really are different. And if you go to the European nations, what did I read the other day? In Denmark, the average Dane goes to church one day, one Sunday a year. If you look at the attendance figures for the church in Europe, it's, you know, 6%, 10% ever go to church. Whereas in America, it's, you know, I see other figures like 30, 40%, what have you. Essentially, Australia and a number of these countries, even the United Kingdom, those are post-Christian nations now. The Anglican Church, the English Church, you know, the state church, actually, is so depleted in England that there are more Anglicans worshiping on Sunday morning in Nigeria than there are in Europe and North America combined. And that's the English church. They have sold down the river. Israel actually has opened itself up. Now, Israel's a little bit more like my original example of people gathered on the shore of Lake Michigan where Al-Qaeda is coming across. Israel is so small that everybody gets drafted for everything. Everybody's got to have a weapon. I remember when President Bush first flew over the West Bank, you know, between the sea and over toward Jerusalem. It's so narrow there that he observed their driveways longer than that in Texas, you know. It's a very small country, and instantaneously they can be in your face, you know, whether they're sweeping down from Golan or up through Gaza and what have you, and we've seen it again and again. But also Israel is very, very secular. To suggest that somehow or other we should follow suit is bizarre. America is quite different. For one thing, we have an incredible advantage in terms of just sheer evangelical Bible Christians in America. There's a fellow named Moskos. He's dead now, but he was a very well-respected poli-sci or soch prophet at Northwestern. And he actually is credited with drafting the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. And he is drawn into some of these conversations. Had a very popular class. He observed that it wouldn't work in America because we are so polarized, that we're a very different society. People feel very strongly against homosexuality and very strongly for, and it's just too hot an issue. I think he misses the point. These guys will say, well, some of these other places are polarized, but he misses the point, and he really couldn't, I think, convictionally make this point, that there are too many Americans who find it to be abominable, and so it won't work. There is just, we can't do monkey see, monkey do with Europe. That would be a disaster, or Canada, for that matter. I think it was in Calgary or Cochrane, Alberta, a little while ago, and they were observing that the Canadian Army has now shrunk to less than the size of the New York Police Department. That so many of these nations depend upon us to provide cover for them, and to say we're going to take our cue from these post-Christian nations whose armies have shrunk is just bizarre. By the way, Moskos, he's an interesting fellow. You remember when the Army switched ads from Be All That You Can Be to Army of One, and they shifted to the Leo Burnett Agency in Chicago and came up with Army of One, and they also have the star logo, that's the newer logo. So anyway, I wasn't real keen on Army of One, and I saw in the Wall Street Journal that Moskos wrote an article against it saying, we don't need a bunch of little prima donnas here who are figuring they're an army of one. Well, yes, you're important and so forth. But anyway, he wrote me the nicest letter back. It was a postcard that had Elvis in an army uniform when he served in Germany, and said thank you. But he's a great guy. He's passed away. But I think he missed it. It's not just that we're polarized, but that we have a greater mass of conviction that is closer to the Bible. And so these other examples I don't think hold so well. Number seven, you know, in the military you have social affairs, you have social functions where you get out the dress blues, and or my son, I always envied my son. My son's a Marine officer, and my eldest son, and they have the cooler uniforms. I just, you know, it really bugs me. But I mean, I've heard snotty people call Marines seagoing bellhops, but you can't deny it. They just have cool uniforms. But when you put on the dress blues, when you have balls and when you have banquets and when you have receptions and so forth, I've tried to see what it would be like if a fella brought his partner to that and was dancing. I mean, there's so many implications here. You think you're granting this, but then you wake up one day and it's like, now in the PX you have homosexual skin magazines, you have men dancing at the brigade ball. I'm just saying, it just gets very, very awkward. I can imagine fist fights. I've even tried to figure out, like, you know, we have O clubs and we have E clubs, and I think we have NCO clubs. Do we have to have H clubs, you know, where they feel more comfortable and they can just hang out in their homosexual setting? Perhaps so. It's like, I remember there was a lake near our town when I grew up called Lake Catherine, is in Arkansas, and they had a bunch of weeds in the lake and it was choking out. So they went to Africa and found some weed-eating carp, and they brought it over, and boy, the weeds went away, but so did all the other fish. And I don't know whether they ate them or ran them off or something like this, but anyway, now you have a lake full of carp. They say with carp, the best way to fix it is to put it between two, like, hickory shingles, and then wire it together and bake it for an hour, and then take it all out and unwrap it and throw away the carp and eat the shingles. It's not a great fish, and they're thinking, we thought we were so smart, but in fact there are ecological impacts that we don't take into account. I suggest there are ecological impacts here that they are not spelling out. And incidentally, they will hide this stuff. You know, when they were talking about the gay marriage deal, I remember Rick Santorum said, wait a second, if we make it okay for consenting adults in love to marry even though they're gay, then what about then polygamy? I mean, you can have grown-ups and we want to be married, but we've made that. And by the way, what about incest? What if a brother and sister want to marry? Well, of course, the pushback was, oh, that's disgusting. We're talking about homosexuality. First, they're denying that there's such a thing as a logical implication. But we're not just talking logic here. We're talking about what will really happen. That they will push every possible limit, and you're going to have bizarro from the PX to the dance floor to the club setting to the parade field and so forth. Number eight, and this is one I don't see mentioned anywhere, so I'm going to explore this. I think there's a point to it. They undermine operations on foreign soil, particularly in low-intensity conflict. I was a mech infantry officer, and we did a lot of training on the plains of Fort Hood, and we would get in mechanized units and 2nd Armored Division, hell on wheels, you know, that sort of thing, and we'd bang around in tracks and with tanks and combined arms, and you had these big set battles, and we were always practicing and we did command post exercises too, where we imagined great Russian or Warsaw Pact armies racing through the Fulda Gap onto the German plain, and we would meet them and with delaying actions and concentrate them and have nuclear strikes and all this kind of stuff. And maybe there will be some of these great tank battles. Maybe there will be some of this stuff in the future. I served at Fort Irwin, where we had these big Op 4 exercises with captured Warsaw Pact armor racing down against units brought in for 2 or 3 week exercises. More and more what we have is low intensity conflict, where you'll put like a team, even a civil affairs team, in to some province in Afghanistan, or they will insinuate themselves into a place in northern Iraq or Tikrit or Ad-Dawaniya or Najaf or someplace like that, and they're building relationships with these tribal leaders, and they are training small units and so forth and so on. You have to be delicate about that. You remember when we were in Saudi Arabia during the first Gulf War, the chaplains couldn't walk into the streets of Riyadh or something with their crosses showing? That you have to be sensitive to the sensitivities of the host country. We do that in missions. You know, I mean, if you think it's cool to smoke a cigar, but you're going to be a missionary to Brazil, they understand down there that smoking is not appropriate for a Christian, and you You just don't exercise whatever liberty you think you have if you're on mission. I'm trying to imagine what it would be like if we had openly gay soldiers working throughout the Middle East and North Africa. I mean, first, it is, in the eyes of God, it is inappropriate. It's even an abomination. To Muslims, it would be, I think, grounds for rejecting a nation's operations there. It would be so disgusting and so forth. Well, you'll just have to, like, suppress it. Okay, so you're saying that we're somehow evil or we have to kowtow to the sensitivities of these people? That might be a good idea. But you just think about if your nation becomes known as one that fields a homosexual army, I say that there are problems on the field in a lot of the host countries. By the way, in Britain, they used to complain that the American flyers, my father-in-law was a bombardier who flew out of Germany in World War II, and they used to say about the Americans, the Brits would say, the British men would say resentfully, these guys are oversexed, overpaid, and over here. They resented the way they were taking British girlfriends and so forth. And those were our friends. If it's awkward to say, oh yeah, the American Army's over here, and they have gays who are looking for action. I would say number nine, they threaten standards of military bearing. Bearing is kind of an awkward thing, you know, if you're just kind of a little nerdy ROTC cadet and you understand that you're supposed to call your people to attention, and you've been saying attention all your life. And so you say, okay, attention, and I won't use the words that they counsel you with about your command voice, but you're supposed to say something that has a little more snap, crackle, and pop to it and a little more heft. It says of the, for example, the command voice, a correctly delivered command will be understood by everyone in the unit. Correct commands have a tone, cadence, and snap that demand willing, correct, and immediate response. I don't get that out of Will and Grace. This is a show that is very, very friendly toward the homosexual agenda. And there is a certain, I mean, Evanston, where I live, has the highest concentration of homosexual couples in all of Chicago suburbs. I think we have 1,000 households. And we have major churches that say they don't discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. And that doesn't mean attendance. That means even like serving on committees and being members and so forth. We have churches, Unitarian and Methodist churches, with pink triangles and rainbow decals on the doors. It's a big deal where I live. And you can tell, in most cases, who is gay and who is not in Starbucks and places like that. There is a certain manner, a certain bearing. And you think, well, it may be artificial, but I'm just telling you, the tradition of the warrior is a tradition where you're more inclined to say, I mean, they discourage you to say it just this way, but like, tune hut, you know, that sort of thing, instead of attention, attention boys, you know, something like this. And, you know, if you want to know the warrior ethos and the warrior bearing, I mean, look at Braveheart, look at Mel Gibson with his face painted blue, look at Patton up on the stage in front of the flag talking to the troops going in. That is the tradition. I mean, if you wanted precedent around the world, you know, the Maori, the tribesmen who grimace and do that, it is an intimidating look. It is a warrior look. And to somehow try to map that on to that, and I could imagine they're just being very offended that you would say, you know, bark these orders and what. Now, they could do it, but we forget bearing is part of what the military honors. Number 10. Those who are openly gay show themselves willing to be radically transgressive. They have run through the barricades, and they resent any notion that there is original sin, that there is human nature, that there is a something that's just radically inappropriate. And we just take that for granted. We say, well, you know, one sin's another sin and something like that. Others disagree about this, and I won't go into great detail about this, but if you've ever heard of the Bloomsburys in England, Lytton Strachey was one who wrote a book called Eminent Victorians, where he poked fun at Charles Gordon and at Florence Nightingale and classic British heroes of morality, the Victorians. And this Bloomsbury group included a variety of people, John Maynard Keynes, the economist, Roger Fry, Clive Bell, E.M. Forster, Virginia Woolf and so forth, and they were sexually very loose. And part of their project was to destroy sexual morality and open it up in... Gertrude Himmelfarb, writing in Commentary Magazine, has this little snippet. In 1907, Strachey discovered that his lover and cousin, Duncan Grant, was also having an affair with Arthur Hobhouse, who in turn was having an affair with Keynes. The following year, Strachey was even more distressed to learn that Grant was now having an affair with Keynes, and so it went. It just goes on, and there was this... Keynes wrote, "We repudiated entirely customary morals, conventions, and traditional wisdom. We were, that is to say, in the strict sense of the term, immoralists. In short, we repudiated all versions of the doctrine of original sin, of there being insane and irrational springs of wickedness in most men." And from this group, there were contacts with what's called, and Ann Coulter wrote about this recently, what's called the Cambridge Five. And it was a group of spies. The most damaging spies in British history were the Cambridge Five, called the Magnificent Five: Kim Philby, Guy Burgess, Anthony Blunt, Donald MacLean, and John Carencross. Highly placed members of British intelligence, all secretly working for the KGB. The only one who wasn't gay was Philby. Burgess and Blunt were flamboyantly gay. Indeed, the Russians set Burgess up with a boyfriend as soon as he defected to the Soviet Union. The Magnificent Five's American compatriot, Michael Strait, was ironically bisexual, as was Whitaker Chambers, at least during the period that he was a spy. And of course, there's David Brock. So many Soviet spies were gay that, according to intelligence reporter Philip Knightley, the Comintern, the Russian leadership, referred to them as the Homintern, as in, or Homintern. There is this latest guy, Bradley Manning, who supposedly spilled all the secrets to the WikiLeaks fella, you know, Assange. He also was gay. And in a number of these cases, there seems to be either an incredible loyalty to friends at the expense of the country, or you have a little snit and there is some sort of vicious reaction that, and there can be a particular viciousness to homosexual love spats. And I don't have time to go into anecdotes and stories, but there is a moral peril in putting homosexuals in very sensitive areas. Time is so short, but we can talk about that even in the Q&A. Number 11, it's a physically perilous lifestyle. We all have medical exams when we go in, and we have them actually frequently. And I remember there was a guy named Kim who was in our unit, and he stood too close to, back when they had recoilless rifles, I think it was a 106 that was firing somewhere, and it messed up his eardrums and his hearing, and he was just out instantly. If you're too short, if you're too tall, if you have traces of tuberculosis, if you have this, if you have that. And not only does it have to do with just your fitness to serve, but it also has to do with, like, whether you are infectious or whether... Even like with battlefield blood transfusions, you know, can your blood be tested and trusted? It's a very unhealthful lifestyle. It's pretty easy to see why it would be, because there are some unnatural and pretty nasty things done in homosexuality. It's not all just cuddling. In fact, if you want to read about the homosexual lifestyle, particularly before the AIDS scare, read "And the Band Played On" by Randy Schiltz about the bathhouse culture of San Francisco and New York. On our website, Kairos Journal, we talk about the health problems. Like the Canadian study of the International Journal of Epidemiology estimated that half of the 20-year-old gay and bisexual men would not reach their 65th birthday. That the current life expectancy of gay men who are 20 is no better than that of men in the 1870s. It's a very dangerous lifestyle. I don't have time to do this, but the list of diseases from syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, giardiasis, I guess it is, and so forth, viral diseases, incidence of herpes, HIV, AIDS, hepatitis. And these soldiers are not just risking behavior among themselves, but they'll hit the towns. You know, if they're sailors, they'll have lovers in every port. And when you go out shopping for sex in those connections, you are introducing a lot of very dangerous things. American studies indicate that hepatitis A is present in approximately 40% of homosexual men. 5 to 7% acquire it annually. The disease produces flu-like symptoms, fever, headache, vomiting, jaundice of the liver, and so forth. And then there's hepatitis B, chronic fatigue, chronic liver disease, death, no effective cure. It just goes on and on. It's a very, very physically dangerous lifestyle. In fact, when you have gay adoption, they have to set aside rules to allow gays to adopt, male gays, because when they're testing adoptive parents, they test them for physical fitness and the prospect. You can't have like super high blood pressure or some communicable disease adopt a kid, but often they will lay aside standards to let gays adopt under political correctness. Let me just mention a 12th one. There are others, but I could say it can mean defections from the warrior class. There is a disproportionate involvement in the military in the Bible Belt. In the South, you have a tradition among evangelicals. Baptists are particularly strong, where they basically believe it is a great way to serve. And so you have many, many, many Southern officers. And then you actually have a lot of officers under conservative Catholics in the Northeast and the like. The people most likely to be in the military are most likely to be offended from this. And when they did by this, and when they did a study recently of impact in the military, quite a few people said, I'm getting out. I mean, you know, in the Army, you have the three-word standard duty, honor, country. And if you diminish the honor of the military, and in fact, sort of the manliness and the sense of duty above personal comfort and desires, when you diminish that, I think the military would be much less attractive to people. So I think they would need to consider defections. When I served in the Pentagon, I did 11 two-week tours in the Pentagon, and I was struck by how many evangelicals there were in our units there. I mean, there are all kinds of Bible studies. I mean, if you look at the bulletin boards in the Pentagon, you'll have flag officers, navigators, and, you know, you have enlisted men's this and evangelicals that. And it's a very, very strong culture. And these are some of the very best people the military has, including our graduate here as Chief of Army Chaplains. To slap that around by acting as though this is no big deal is to risk losing some of your best men. Now, look, the military spirit is yes, sir, can do, salute, continue to march, work with all kinds of stuff, but I think it could take a toll. Well, I can't say any one of these 12 is totally defeating, but I think taken together, they at least suggest that this would be a very imprudent thing to withdraw. And actually, we would be running ahead of Germany in this, you know, and some other countries. It is just a social agenda that is being foisted on us in terms of political correctness, sensitivity, and I would say moral relativism, sexual liberty, and don't use the military to do that. Don't use this as your tool. Thank God Harry Truman said, I'll use the military to straighten our minds out on racial prejudice. But one does not choose to be black or white, or what have you. One does choose to act upon certain desires. You say, well, yeah, but they're born that way with this desire. You're born being attracted to women, and they're born attracted to men. How dare you pass judgment? Look, if I had to honor everything I was born, every tendency I was born with, you say, oh, is that the deal? If I'm born with a tendency, then I should honor it and embrace it and have a parade to celebrate it? I think I was born to, like, desired to take things that didn't belong to me without telling, and then I have them and I didn't pay for them. I think I shoplifted something when I was 8, some model airplane glue. You know, I had the paint, I didn't pay for it, what's not to like? And that was a sin. Oh, but no, it's not a sin. I had a tendency to do it. I desired to do it. So we'll celebrate that. So we'll have like Theft Pride Day. Look, we're born with all kinds of tendencies, and some are honorable and some are not. Some are destructive and some are actually, they cause us to flourish. But we are crossing a very, very serious boundary when we as a nation not only legalize homosexuality, but affirm it, normalize it, rationalize it, and defend it against critics. And it just breaks my heart to see this sort of movement. Well, anyway, that's what comes to mind today. And if you feel a sermon coming on, we've got a few minutes here. Or if you have questions, I had to race over some things, but happy to develop something. Or you may just want to, as Forrest Gump did, run away. What do you think, guys? Anything? Or ladies? Yes. Yes, sir. Right.
The SBC was discussing, you know, the possibility that because the SBC has the most active duty chaplains, that they would withdraw the chaplains. You know anything?
I don't know about, I mean, the first part, the Protestant and evangelical and SBC chaplain presence is huge. And if you read Catholic magazines, you'll see that the Pentagon, Department of Defense, is working desperately to recruit more and more priests. I mean, they have a shortage of priests in America anyway, but then in the military and certainly with other groups. I don't know that the North American Mission Board would withdraw endorsement for chaplains and withdraw their people. I kind of doubt that they would do that. They might say, all the more we need to have. But you might say, at a certain point, you make serving as a Christian chaplain so untenable that we can no longer in good conscience send people into your meat grinder because you are denying the gospel and the clear teaching of Scripture. You're forcing us to muffle what we know to be true. That would be pretty radical, I think, but it's conceivable. And they would perhaps take notice. It's a good question. I just don't know about that particular motion, but you're right, we're a huge presence. Right. It's again, it's news to me, but that could send a shot across the bow. Like, are you sure you want to do this? Do you know what? But to just see the president and those who he's, I think, pleasing, just say, hey, this is where we're going, you know, this is just simple. By the way, this ploy, this civil rights ploy, like, you know, it was Martin Luther King, you know, in the 60s, and now it's this. There is a world of difference between that. There is nothing dishonorable about being black. That there is actually everything honorable. That is, you're made in the image of God and so forth. There is definitely something dishonorable about being actively homosexual. And to put the two together, and there are a lot of civil rights people who are saying, what are you doing? I mean, are you saying it's like what we went through? Are you nuts? You know, incidentally, I mean, people really have the ability not to do certain things. I mean, it's not like getting typhus. It's a choice you make. And you think, well, it's not look, it's not natural for me to sit through some sermons, long sermons that are boring. You know, I just want to flop over on the seat, you know, and just get in the fetal position and sleep. But there's something about being a grown-up, and this isn't most sermons, but some sermons, there's something about being a grown-up that involves, like, sitting up, being alert and attentive and responsive with your face. If we just did everything we felt like doing, can you imagine what lunacy? I mean, from traffic to you name it. But anyway, yes, sir.
I understand chaplaincy in general as having cooperation but not compromise. Have you heard anything in regards to, like, Muslim chaplaincy, what they would do?
That's interesting, because they would also, I mean, there are chaplains and there are chaplains. I mean, you've got the whole lineup, and perhaps some Muslim chaplains would be laid back. I mean, there is a certain kind of diplomacy that some exercise in America where they, but I would think they would be as inflamed as the Christian chaplains would be. We don't have statistically as many Muslim chaplains, or certainly not many Muslims in the military, but I wouldn't be surprised if they would, if the SBC walks out, or they might walk out quicker. I'm not sure. It's a good question, because, by the way, the vast majority of people on earth know that this is abnormal. That's a perversion. I mean, even like cool people know that. The Dalai Lama has spoken out against homosexuality. You know, you don't have to be somebody from Westboro Baptist Church, you know, somewhere off in Kansas, to know something's wrong. And even on cool shows like Seinfeld, you know, they'll make a joke about it. You know, someone will say, oh, no, I'm not gay. Not that there's anything wrong about that. But they're just mouthing a certain kind of political correct thing and making fun of it. So it's, I mean, no father said, you know, I've had like three straight kids. I'm just praying that we'll have a gay kid. It's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking. And to act as though it's just like whatever is an act of national perversion and national stupidity. Other things come to mind? All right. Yes, sir.
Even from Focus on the Family, one thing they said about this is that the timing is very poor with being at war, two different wars at this time. You know, the timing is so poor to even look to repeal this because there's enough stress on troops.
Absolutely.
Deployed multiple times. And, you know, like you said, privacy issues because you are in different environments. Not like you're 9 to 5, you know, when you're deployed.
Yeah.
You know, not like a 9 to 5 job.
You do. And again, it just underscores the willfulness of this thing. It's not as though, like, we've studied this and think it would be a help. It's like in the midst of all this craziness, it's like, hey, we're going to push this. In fact, in the midst of all the furor in North Africa, you know, Tunisia and Libya and all this sort of stuff, and in the midst of all the stresses and stuff in Afghanistan, what do? We bring up this. It just shows this is just such a blind ahead, change the character of America agenda that it has nothing to do with military readiness and military effectiveness. It's hijacking the military for part of the project. It's shameful, I would say. Yeah.
When is this going to be put in effect, first? And secondly, is there any talks of Congress basically voting this out?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's possible. I mean, I do think, I mean, I guess people are looking toward 2012 in a sense, like saying maybe you get a critical mass and you reverse this in the Congress and so forth. And again, this has, in the spirit of Harry Truman and the spirit of the Bible, this has nothing to do with President Obama's race. It has everything to do with his policies. And if this is one of the policies, then it should be repudiated. I mean, some policies can be good, some are bad, but I think this is dreadful. I do think that there are a lot of people who are susceptible to the notion that we have no right to judge someone's homosexuality. You know, I mean, just there are a lot of libertarians. It's not just a Republican-Democrat thing. I mean, in the Republican Party, you have different sectors. You have the values Republican, the James Dobson sort of Republican, so to speak, and then you have sort of the economic Republicans, you know, the low tax system and encourage business and, you know, don't tread on us, free enterprise. And by the way, there's overlap with a lot of these. And then you have the libertarian Republicans. Don't make me wear a motorcycle helmet and don't make me throw away my incandescent light bulbs and, you know, tell me who I have to pick for my medical care and so forth. So you have libertarians, values guys, and then you could say economics guys. And there are libertarians in the Republican Party who would say, how dare we judge, you know, listen, just let them in there and the like. So it's not strictly along party lines, but the center of mass of enthusiasm for repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell right now is in the Democratic Party. And I just find it ridiculous. And I find it really sad. The Marines are usually tougher on this than the Army. You know, the Marines are slower and they're saying, what are you? And they're the same thing with women in combat. I am very very disappointed with Admiral Mullen, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He seems to be right along with it. Gates rolls over. I think that's bad behavior for the military. I thank God for the witness of the Marines, which is typically stouter. But it's kind of a nutty thing that I think could be repealed. But I'm finding that America is becoming increasingly morally confused. And we may just not have the critical mass left anymore to take stands like this. I hope we do. Yeah.
I'm intending to go into the chaplaincy, and so with that in mind, assuming that it's in state after I graduate, how would I, as a chaplain, ethically just deal with this? I mean,
well, I know chaplains have. My dad was a chaplain in World War II in the South Pacific, and my father-in-law was a full bird chaplain, head of National Guard chaplains for four states, Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Oklahoma, I think it was. And so I've been around chaplains a lot. I was infantry, never a chaplain. I do think there are, and I've worked with chaplains, some extraordinary chaplains at Fort Irwin and other places, and I really do think that basically, I mean, a lot of what chaplains do is just moral counseling. Don't go to town and get an infectious disease, or, you know, organizing activities for the preservation of families while troops are overseas. And there's just a lot of stuff that you do. But you do have the preaching. You have the pulpit. And I think that you just preach the Word of God. And we just signed a thing recently called the Manhattan Declaration that says, listen, we're not going to be bowed by speech codes, and I would say in or out of the military. When push comes to shove, we're just going to say what the Bible says. And if you're going to have to throw us in jail, throw us out of this or that, you know, do what you got to do. We're going to do what we got to do. You know, we can read Pilgrim's Progress too, and we know where John Bunyan wrote a lot of his stuff. It was in jail. So I think probably when, and you don't go out of your, you're not like a dog that chases every car. You're not looking for a fight, and you're not, you're doing your thing. But when the time comes to open the Word of God, and you choose as a chaplain to preach through Romans or whatever, then you do it. And you just say, here's what the Word of God says. And if you get in trouble for that, and you're disbarred, then all of a sudden, we might even spark a revolution in America or something like this. But in many cases, we're more cowed than we need to be. You know, people say, oh, you can't say that. I mean, I am a church planter in Evanston. And you're poverty struck when you're a church planter. And so I would go to substitute in Evanston Public Schools. And so you know how they call you at 6 in the morning and you get like a folder and these things that you're supposed to do. And you're really babysitting and giving them make work and trying to keep the thugs from killing you or each other. But anyway, one day I had Catcher in the Rye. We're going to discuss Catcher in the Rye. And so Holden Caulfield, you know, he's obscene, he's flippant, he's nihilistic, he's cool, he's everything the high school students want to be. So he's very dismissive and so forth. And I said, what is the problem here, do you think? What does he need? And so they give several answers. And I said, you know, maybe, what if he needs God in his life? A little hand shot up in the back and said, you can't say that. Evanston's very politically correct. We call it the People's Republic of Evanston. And it's like, oh, I can't say that. So we can read a book where he says GD in the book, but we can't suggest that maybe his problem is he's taking a wrong stance toward God. Well, the kid was wrong. You can raise that as an issue. But we're so cowed we think we can't do things. I've had chaplains say, I have never had to blink when I'm preaching the Word of God. Now look, my dad, I've got his kit. He died at age 100. I've got his chaplain's kit. And we've got a little cross in there that on one side it's plain, and the other side you flip it and you snap on Jesus and you snap on, like, Inri, you know, Jesus Nazarenus, you know, and then he has like little St. Christopher medals or something like that, or little Mary's, I don't know what. And when you're the only chaplain, I mean, he was one on Guadalcanal. When you're on the only chaplain in that sector of a Pacific island, and you've got a Jewish guy coming up, you give him, you know, something like whatever they supplied the Jewish soldiers with. And then if a Catholic comes in, you don't have to offer them Mass, but you might enable them somehow to have a layman or a deacon to do that. You don't send them away and say, you know, this is popish sacramentalism. You're the man who is the chaplain for the area. So I'm not saying you are just like a Baptist pastor at Second Baptist Houston. But when the time comes to break open the Word of God or to speak plainly in counseling about the counsel of God, I would say do it. And I hope that our chaplains do that. And if it blows up in their face, then maybe that will spark something that needs to be sparked. Now, you know, you have Air Force Academy tensions where, I don't know, the commander gets up and says to everybody, all right, you guys all need to find Jesus. You know, your Camp Crusade may come by tonight in the dorm, and everybody kind of listen to him. That's overreaching to, in a sense, pressure people. But to say that commander himself can't, for example, speak at a prayer breakfast, I'm just saying they will push as much as you can. But there is a decorum, and there's a sense of what's right. But I'd say stick with it and just honor the Word of God and see what happens. These are very interesting times. By the way, I'll just close with this. Working with Kairos Journal, we have worked with people who have put it out on the line in liberal societies who have been smashed for taking a stand. There's a guy named Aka Green who is like a 65-year-old Pentecostal pastor on an island off the coast of Sweden. And he saw that there was going to, and there are more cows on this island than people, all right? And he saw that there was going to be a gay pride parade in Stockholm. And this was like in November, and it was going to be in March. So he spent some time working on this message about homosexuality, what the Bible says. And when he finally got it worked up, he notified the local radio station that he was going to preach a message on it. They released it to the Rainbows or whatever it was. And the next thing you know, he's being sued for defamation or vilification or whatever you want to call it, gay bashing. Well, this dear old guy, he was charged with something and he appealed it and went to the Supreme Court of like Sweden. He became a little bit of a celebrity. The Polish parliament had him come over and speak. But as I understand it, he was finally hauled before the Supreme Court for defaming gays or something like this. And they asked him in court, well, what exactly did you say? And so he got to repeat it on Swedish radio, which was kind of funny. But he was acquitted, but it's like you go all the way to the Supreme Court for like preaching a sermon in a liberal country. And Mark Stein has run into this with Islam in Canada, and Daniel Scott with Islam in Australia. He said critical things of Islam. He was a math teacher. They said, you've got to take out $80,000 worth of ads in the Melbourne papers apologizing to the Muslims for criticizing them. He challenged and went all the way to the Supreme Court of Australia. Have we lost our minds that you can't criticize just in your generation? It's not just a chaplain thing. It's a society thing. And some of us may have to go to jail before this is all ironed out.